Good morning. Before scientists leave the Association of Tropical Biology and Conservation Conference, they have a few pointed words about Kahoʻolawe. A senior scientist in the biology department at Stanford University explains the association's position. And 4 months ago, development in Malay Kahana was off the table. Now it's back in the revised Koʻalaloa Sustainable Communities Plan. We'll talk with Councilman Ikaika Anderson about whether he believes it's for procedural purposes only. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Hip-hop is everywhere in our culture these days, giving a new generation its own self-created means of expression. We'll hear about it from Deadbeats co-founder Harumi Jerome. And the Little Flea has a global reach these days. We'll meet one of the members of Ukuleles for Peace, Muslim and Jewish teenagers from Israel, with a message.
It's Thursday, July 16th. The conversation starts after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
To understand modern Hawaii, you really have to kind of understand the story of Kahoʻolawe, don't you?
In many ways, yes. And that is why a lot of scientists who've been in Honolulu over the last few days are now going to be issuing a statement about that. So we're going to talk about that first this morning. Now, later today, the scientists from the Association of Tropical Biology and Conservation will bring their largest ever conference to a close. Before they leave Hawaii, they're issuing a statement about the status of Kahoʻolawe. Dr. Jose Fragoso is a senior scientist in the biology department at Stanford University. He's also the co-chair of the Conservation Committee for the association, and he joins us this morning. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you very much for having me here and to speak about this important issue that our society members are very concerned with.
You mentioned that they are concerned with this issue. How did you find that out?
I actually was a professor at UH Manoa for a number of years and was aware of some of the issues, but our society also canvasses all of our members in Hawaii to identify the most pressing conservation issues.
And you did that as part of the fact that you were going to be here in Hawaii and looking at issues of local concern, and you would do that in any location where you would go.
Exactly. So every time we meet, and because we're an international organization, we meet in different places in the world, and every place we ask our members to identify what is important to the local conservation community that we as a society can attempt to help resolve using the weight of our membership, which is mostly scientists and a scientific society.
And then once you have identified that, to integrate that into the overall agenda for the conference. Now, when you canvassed the members from Hawaii and Kahoʻolawe came up as a tie with water issues.
Yes, they actually, in Hawaii, it was very difficult to identify one issue. And those of us who've lived in Hawaii know that there are many issues of concern. All of them had to do with how we manage our land and how we manage our water resources. And they were tied closely to issues of concern to Native Hawaiians as well. So the water issue, for example, tied very nicely to concerns of the Ahupua form of land management. So it tied both the land and the water. And Kahoʻolawe as well tied those concerns of environment and people, but it also had the potential to serve as a model for the rest of the world, because the issues we've seen in Kahoʻolawe resonate with many different places and across the tropical world. So although the issue was identified by key members and members of our society here who had reached out to the broader society in Hawaii, they also tied with concerns of the society members as a whole.
As you look at Kahoʻolawe, as you say, as being a model for other places in the world, where specifically would be someplace that would be similar to what we've seen happen with Kahoʻolawe?
It's probably not best to name specific sites, but some places in the Philippines come to mind. There are a number of places in South America and the Amazon that come to mind that there are similar issues about land use, native or indigenous people's use of the land, former use by military, either for training or bombing as well. So these sort of have a broader kind of reach across the world.
As you look at Kahoʻolawe specifically, though, knowing that the funds that were once appropriated to be able to clean up and fix it have now dwindled to their very last few dollars, and now there's still quite a bit more yet to do, even in the way the ordinance was clear, that wasn't done 100%, that there's never been truly 100% of the restoration that was supposed to happen, which is what you and the association have been calling for.
Yes, so we at the ATBC, when we looked at this issue and we thought more about it, we actually then go into finding out more details and more deeply understanding the issue. So we contacted more people after the initial identification. And as you say, we found that the money that had been allocated for the removal of ordnance and the restoration of the island was inadequate, and that was fairly clear now, perhaps not back then. And we identified that as in our declaration. That's actually the main item we identify, is the need to complete the work that was agreed to by the U.S. government through the military, and that'll involve adding more funds to the completion, especially now that all funds that were available have been depleted. And so the necessity to finish the work is as acute as it was when we first started.
Do you believe that the government will be sensitive to that acuity?
I would hope so. I was speaking to someone and trying to explain why it's important that the U.S. government complete its contract and its promises for Kahoʻolawe. And I sort of thought about it in the same way that, as a country, the United States approaches its veterans. It's a rare instance that our country abandons its veterans without fully ensuring that they're being cared for with health care, with adequate retirement payments and that sort of thing. And in a way, I look at Kahoʻolawe, my understanding of it is Kahoʻolawe also served our military. It came out of World War II. It did its service. It completed and served for about 50 years. And then we're sort of abandoning it. It's not something, we wouldn't have abandoned our soldiers, and we don't abandon our soldiers that have served. So why is the U.S. government abandoning Kahoʻolawe when it has served the purposes of our society so greatly?
Some might suggest that all you have to do is look back into our very, very recent history to see some of the issues with veterans and getting health care and getting it in an appropriate time frame to suggest that maybe your argument, as good as it might feel, is not necessarily a reflection of reality.
And I agree very much with that statement. That's why we greatly need our state representatives in Washington to take up this issue. We see that when veterans are brought up as an issue, there's usually a groundswell of support for resolving those issues. We see that with the recent issue with veterans and health care. Yes, the problem was there. Yes, the problem was identified. Once identified, this upwelling of support for resolution, both public and political support, was very great. And we need that sort of response from our community as well, but especially from our senators and our congressmen here in Hawaii to take this up, take it back to Washington and say, you can't just drop this. You can't just leave it as it is.
Leaving the it being Kahoʻolawe.
Yes, leaving Kahoʻolawe in this state it did its service. The Hawaiian community, the Native Hawaiian community, the people of Hawaii provided this land, supported its use in support of our military. Now we need it fully cleaned.
So, Dr. Fragoso, what happens now as you and the 500-plus members leave Hawaii and go back to the 50 countries from whence they came, and leaving this declaration behind about Kaho'olawe, what do you hope will happen will to do with it now that will give it, you know, some weight, some teeth?
Well, one thing we've identified, that it'll probably take about $1 billion to fully clean and restore the island. These are based on calculations estimated from what it has already cost to clean as much as we have. And what we leave is this declaration. The declaration is important because it actually goes around the world. So we think of it as having local importance, but our declarations, because it's made by an important community of scientists, actually makes its way to Italy, to Europe, to other countries, and they'll be reading about the situation in Kaho'olawe. They'll be reading around the world about what's happening here. And I would like to think that that understanding that the rest of the world has now of Kaho'olawe, and an additional effort from our politicians to sort of restore the funding that's needed, coupled together to sort of give the world a better picture of what Hawaii is about and what it's doing for its environment and its people.
Dr. Jose Fragoso, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for the time here.
Dr. Jose Fragoso is a senior scientist in the biology department at Stanford University. He's also co-chair of the Conservation Committee for the Association of Tropical Biology and Conservation, wrapping up their conference in Honolulu this week. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:16, and in just a few minutes, the Deadbeats are bringing a new perspective out to the Atherton studio. We'll meet the group's MC, Harumi Jerome, but first, here's your backyard quiz.
Have you ever examined a lizard's gizzard? If not, this morning you'll get a chance. The most well-known lizard in Hawaii is, of course, the gecko, but there are 5 species of lizards that call our islands home. Jackson chameleons, skinks, green iguanas, and inoles can be found throughout Hawaii. This morning, we're looking at a little bit of the anole anatomy. Ranging in color from green to gray, this small reptile spends most of its time in the sun to maintain its core temperature. What makes him such an interesting little guy is the flap of skin beneath its mouth that can be expanded on command. It's used for 2 purposes. Mainly, it's a display to attract females during mating season. The second purpose is quick communication to other adult males that they've strayed into the wrong place at the wrong time and should be prepared for fight or flight. Our question for today, what's the proper name for this throat balloon? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first caller to get it right wins an HPR t-shirt.
Aloha kakahiaka, I'm Victoria Nalani Nubel, I'm an author, and I'm listening to The Conversation. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
I love a tattoo, that's true, but that don't mean a blank canvas can't move. I love a discussion, honest conversations, not assumptions. I love to laugh and I hate to cry, so I just get buzzed enough to get by. And I love the sound the haters make when they're just about to get another taste of the free fly, flow, foam, forget grinding bones. I'm so dope.
It may seem hard to believe, but rock and roll was once dismissed as a passing fad, even as it was taking over the culture. Hip-hop seems to be going through the same cycle, and by now there's no doubt that it's here to stay. High time, then, for it to be featured in one of our HPR Atherton concerts. The Deadbeats will be in our studio this weekend, bringing influences from performance art and poetry to their work, and group founder and MC Harumi Jerome is with us this morning. Good morning, Harumi.
Good morning.
You know, there was a time when people wouldn't even known what the role of an MC in a band was.
Yeah.
Not that long ago. What is that role?
Historically, it's the hype man of the group. But that kind of goes back to days where DJing was, you know, the primary source of party entertainment. The MC would be the guy, you know, on the microphone, you know.
Get this party started.
Exactly, yeah. Get your hands in the air. And
yeah, now you just don't care.
Exactly, so to speak.
Yeah.
Now it's just, you know, delivering words, being the front man, being, you know, delivering ideas along with the music.
Are some of those ideas coming to you in the moment?
Sometimes, yeah. When the group had originally got together, we only had maybe like worked out six songs or so, and we were playing at Jazz Minds on Kapi'olani for a period of 3 hours. So a lot of that was improvisation, and it was exhausting and also exhilarating for me.
Sure.
Because so much of it was just thought up at the spawn spot. I look back, you know, lovingly, but it was very nerve-wracking.
I would imagine, yeah, six songs get you most of the way through one set, right?
Exactly. We scattered them so that it seemed like we knew what we were doing throughout the span of time.
I'm familiar with those tricks.
Yeah.
But at the same time, your words are playing a big part in this. This isn't just sounds. This is a message, yeah?
Oh, sure, yeah. I spend a lot of time writing it, and I go through several drafts for most of this song, especially now that I've kind of grown as a writer.
It's tricky to have crafted language that maintains and I'm figuring you want to have still a sort of an in-the-moment, spontaneous feel to the delivery at the same time, right?
Yeah. And I that's also something that has to be considered when writing, because so much of what we're doing is in live performance.
Sure.
So most of the sound systems that we've come across, you know, it's very hard for people to understand what I'm saying in the moment when we're playing it live.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to make sure that the delivery of it is interesting, that the sound of my voice kind of plays as an instrument in itself.
Has to work as sound, even if you don't know, if can't make out what you're saying.
Right. And hopefully, you know, a few ideas are you know, received.
But that's where it differs from strict spoken word, where you actually are adapting spoken word to a musical accompaniment and making it into a kind of a nonverbal music at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah. The challenging and easier part of live poetry is that your voice is the only instrument involved.
Right.
So you have, while the timing is not, you can dictate your own timing with the delivery of what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
When it's over a beat, you have to follow that beat with as much, you know, more carefully, I suppose. But I began writing poetry before I started, you know, before they got transcribed into lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a very close relation to the poetry aspect of things.
But now I would think that, but I would think your writing now would have the rhythm in it sort of from the beginning.
Yeah, probably so. If I were to try, and I haven't written a poem in a long time, which is a shame. I should do that again.
Because it'd be interesting to see if you can get those beats out of your head.
Exactly. They've been hammered pretty hard at this point.
It's kind of like your iambic pentameter. I mean, hip-hop has a very distinct set of rhythms, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's set to a four beat. Although there is one song on our last album, Do You, that's 1 in 3, which was really fun to write to, because it, like you said, it was reprogramming myself to not deliver it in the same way. It was, I kind of had to hold back a beat, made sure that the words kind of fit within that pentameter.
Well, after a while, everything in the world being in 4/4 time can get pretty monotonous.
True.
And and we're so locked into 4/4 in the West. You get out beyond America and you find out that there are actually other rhythms besides 1, 2, 3, 4, right?
Yeah.
So I think that would be a challenge for you to craft your words. Do you have specific preoccupations in terms of subject matter?
Well, up until recently, we've kind of been more of a party band, so to speak, where we, you know, we'll play, bars and clubs and stuff to get people to dance.
So that's get up and dance.
That's get up and go, exactly. MCs to the truest.
Yeah.
So that's what I had been writing about. More recently, you know, I just turned 30, so I'm hitting that benchmark for myself.
Uh-huh.
So I've been more focusing on personal stuff. In the past, I've been avoiding personal stuff by talking about partying.
Yeah.
Now I'm getting a little more... a little more, personal.
This is a life cycle you're describing. Yeah. You realize that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
20s to 30s. There's a definite evolution going on there.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
but you now have a vehicle for your expression as well,
which I'm very grateful for. Yeah, and it's therapeutic as it is fun, and it's enjoyable, which is why the show. This weekend is going to be a lot of fun because we're featuring songs from, 8 years ago,
mm-hmm.
Where I was, just this, we are all these young kids just playing to have fun and, kind of just playing to cover our bar tabs till now when we're, older, kind of experienced the scene a little bit.
Hoping for something more than a free bar tab.
Exactly.
Out of the experience. Again, a life cycle continuing on into the future for you.
Yeah. I'm definitely looking to explore the changes in music and writing that, because I feel like I'm going through a boom right now.
Yeah.
So, when I get to the side of that curtain, I want to be better for it,
Well, if you feel yourself to be in a boom phase, you should write like crazy so that you got some output, right, while the inspiration is with you.
Strike while the iron is hot.
There you go.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Harumi Jerome is the MC and founder of the Deadbeats. He'll be performing in HPR's Atherton Studio this Saturday at 7:30. And you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Where the hopscotch boxes blotched after the rain fell, causing the chalk to walk. And upon these paved roads is where the days unfold. And two complete strangers fall in love, it ain't over. And these streets are jazzy as you can see. It magically renders a man's imagination free. And a man shakes cans, the rattling bomb walls. We're all calling each other bizarre, maybe we all are. And the door across the hall is getting locked again. Woman needs to work and man has to have his harlequin. The lights of the city assume control. And you
on August 9th, HPR brings you a special gathering of Slack Key Masters Keola Beamer and Jeff Peterson, Kumuhula Moanalani Beamer, bassist and vocalist Nathan Aviau, and dancer Kavena Meckler. It'll be an afternoon of favorite tunes from back in the day and a celebration of Hawaiian music today. That's August 9th at the Palikū. Reservations at hprtickets.org or by calling 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored in part by Servco Toyota Dealers and the Toyota Prius.
C is for charity. The nation's largest charity evaluator has always awarded HPR its highest rating for the third year in a row. Donors can be confident that their hard-earned dollars will be used efficiently and responsibly. For their generosity, we thank members Michelle Umapeg of Honolulu, Jeff Kishinger of Kapa'a, and Renee Ramsey of Kailua. Consider supporting HPR with a charitable gift Our secure website, hawaiipublicradio.org, is always open.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, protecting and managing Oahu's drinking water resources. Learn 7 ways to save water at boardofwatersupply.com.
Tuesday's community meeting over concerns about the Mauna Loa Bay proposal to expand the marine sanctuary was scheduled for 7 o'clock, but by 6, the opponents to the plan were already out in full force. Did the community get and hear the answers to their concerns? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has some in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
That was some meeting that night.
Yeah, and I got to give credit to Nathan Eagle and Corey Lum, our reporter and photographer. They were there. They stuck around. And you can just look at the photos that Corey has up on our story on this on the meeting. A lot of unhappy campers there in Hawaii Kai, very concerned about these new rules for Mauna Loa Bay, which they're being proposed. And, of course, we're talking about that area of water between Diamond Head and Cocoa Head. And it doesn't sound like they got a lot of satisfaction from what they heard from people like Suzanne Case, who's the chair of the land board, or Malia Chow, who's in charge of the sanctuaries.
I mean, looking at some of those photos and having been there and seeing the faces,
right,
and knowing that people came in with real anger, real concerns about a great many things, do you think they were able actually to hear some of the answers that seemed to contradict some of the things that they believed walking in?
The way that Nathan put it was, even though Case and Chow tried to answer the questions that were they were being peppered with, they didn't seem satisfied. And so what he says in his article is there was a lot of hooting, a lot of hollering, a lot of boos. I mean, a big concern that business owners and homeowners in the area have is what's going to happen to commercial and recreational use of the bay? Is that going to be in jeopardy? Because the plan here is to take the bay, which is currently in the Humpback Whale Sanctuary, it's been there since 97, and actually have it be its own special sanctuary area. And the concern is, well, that's going to really limit what you can do in the bay. And folks didn't seem to get satisfactory answers to clear that up.
Some things that began to come out that, yes, you can, if you want to release the ashes of a loved one, you can do that. That's not going to be prohibited. Other things like the issue of dredging came up and looking at exceptions for being able to maintain a marina or harbor. There were some very nuanced things that not quite sure they were able to make inroads. And also, given the way Suzanne Case says, you know, it's not the state's place to comment on the proposal, but to, you know, be part of the process seemed to make people a little upset too.
Exactly. I'll just give you one example. Gene Ward, the area representative, said, can you build a sandcastle on the beach? Because the rules seem to imply that the highest wash of the waves would be covered by that sanctuary. In other words, where you build a sandcastle will be wiped out. No, you couldn't build it. Well, it turns out you probably could, but it doesn't sound like it was really clear in the rules. And that's the whole point. NOAA, the state, the feds will be reviewing these rules over the next 6 months to a year, and they will be looking at those public comments.
And there will be more of them coming, no doubt. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you in the morning, Chad. Thanks.
Thanks, Beth Ann. Bye-bye.
Chad Blair is a political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Hi, good morning. I'm Ani Kailia-Stevens from Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR Hawaii Public Radio.
Tonight at 5, Beth Ann will be bringing us Town Square. And there's been a changing world for charitable giving and those who depend upon it, yeah?
And a changing world for the better in many cases. You might remember that a few weeks ago we got the Giving USA report saying that Americans had donated an estimated $358 billion to charity last year, and that was the highest total in that report's 60-year history. Well, we're going to take that apart and really look at it from a Hawaii perspective tonight. We're going to be speaking with Kelvin Takeda, the president and CEO of the Hawaii Community Foundation. Also, Lisa Maruyama will be here from the Hawaii Alliance of Nonprofit Organizations. And we'll really see what that picture looks like when we deeply dive into how Hawaii giving has worked over the last little while, the pre-recession years to now.
It's a very encouraging number, given the recession that we've been going through, yeah?
Nationally, it's a very encouraging number, but yeah. Part of the issue is, you know, what happened right at the recession? Where was everybody else relative to where Hawaii was?
Yeah.
And how much of a hill did we have to climb to be able to get back to pre-recession levels, and are we there yet? We'll find out tonight at 5.
Fair enough. That's tonight at 5 on Town Square on HPR2.
Months ago, it looked like any reference to housing development in Malaikahana was off the table. But now it's showing up in a bill by Honolulu City Council Chairman Ernie Martin. It's part of the revised Ko'olaloa Sustainable Communities Plan. Earlier this morning, I talked with Councilman Ikaika Anderson, who has opposed housing development in Malaikahana. I asked him if the reintroduction of housing development in the area came as a surprise.
No, I'm not surprised, because Bill 47 from 2013 has expired. It's reached the end of its two-year life cycle, and Council Chair Ernie Martin, so that the bill could continue moving along, the measure could continue moving along, simply reintroduced what was already in front of the council.
So there was no way of being able to amend it, because, of course, that would make it something new.
Correct. There was no way to amend the existing bill, because officially the bill had not been amended by the council, only by committee.
So at this point, where he has said that this is strictly procedural, do you believe Ernie Martin?
Absolutely. Ernie is absolutely correct in that his reintroduction of the Ko'olaloa Sustainable Communities Plan is purely procedural. And the chairman is aware of my intent to amend Bill 53 to match the amendments that I made to Bill 47, removing the Malaikahana development from the proposed plan.
And that would be the only way that you would ever go along with it, is that if Malaikahana were not on the table?
I wouldn't be able to support the bill if that amendment were not made.
At this point, though, the fact that it's still in there, that seems to give some hope to those who would like to see housing go into Malaikahana. What would you want to tell them?
If they want to see that as a possibility that the housing proposal may be part of the plan, okay. I certainly have not removed my opposition, and unless a majority of the members of the Zoning and Planning Committee have removed theirs, I don't see how that housing plan could go forward.
Keeping it in the context of what the community wants, as you talk to the folks out there and looking at organizations, including Defend Oahu Coalition and just the residents that you talk to, Malaikahana for them is an absolute verboten place to put housing, isn't it?
Really, Bethan, what I think this boils down to is implementation of the Oahu General Plan. And the Oahu General Plan does not call for urban growth in the Malaikahana area. The urban growth boundary simply does not extend into that area. And to put housing there at this point, to me, is just poor public policy.
I'm just trying to see whether or not there's a real understanding of what the community wants and how in touch the council feels that it really is with that community.
I do believe that the council is in touch with what the community wants out there. From what I've heard from most residents in the Ko'olaloa area, and even those in the Ko'olaupoko area, housing in that area, in the Malaikahana area, is not something that the community at large desires. But so, it's also uniform with the Oahu General Plan.
So as we've talked about the Oahu General Plan before and looking at the growth and the way that it's happened out in the area, what do you see happening to be able to meet some of the need? Because we always hear that we need to have more and more affordable housing out there for those who live and work in the area, especially seeing the growth?
Really, what I think the answer to that is going to be adding additional accessory dwelling units, or ADUs, that the city council is currently working on that will allow for additional living spaces for families to be constructed in existing areas. Additionally, I believe that new housing projects will also meet that need. But I don't think that we can go ahead and implement large-scale additional new housing projects in Malaikahana or anywhere else that's not marked for more urban growth just to satisfy a housing need.
Even for a housing need that, say, Brigham Young University says it needs?
In regards to Brigham Young University Hawaii, I'm not at all convinced that the university should be looking at doubling its current enrollment size. Perhaps Brigham Young University Hawaii needs to go back to the drawing board on their existing plan. I don't think they need to expand their existing enrollment by double. That's part of what they're talking about. They should revisit that.
And in revisiting that, what else do you think might have to also be revisited about the general growth of the area? Because all of them seem to piggyback on the growth of the university. The university grows, they're going to need more housing, they're going to need more services, they're going to need more businesses to support everyone. So are you really telling the area, stay small?
I believe what we're telling the university is that they were never really expected to double their enrollment. When they first came into existence, they discussed with the community exactly what services they intended to offer, the enrollment size of the university. Now all of a sudden they're telling the community, well, we need to double our enrollment. I'm not convinced that BYUH needs to do that. And if they do, then they need to make arrangements for that growth and expansion within their own campus and not expect the city council or government in general to move the urban growth boundary to meet their needs. So in short, that's BYUH's private problem. It's not government's problem to address that for them.
So as long as they maintain their same footprint, that's not an issue. It's just simply a matter of moving beyond that that causes a big issue for you.
That's correct. And again, I would tell BYUH, that's your problem. You deal with it. You want to increase your enrollment? You want to increase your size? That's fine. You figure out how to deal with that problem within your campus. If you can't, tough luck, I would say.
Tough luck. Okay. As this bill goes forward, I'm sure we'll be talking to you then, but at what point do you expect the reference to Malaikahana to be removed from the procedural activity of simply keeping the bill alive?
Well, I believe what will happen at this point is the bill will go to the full city council for first reading. After that, it will then be referred to committee, likely the Zoning and Planning Committee. And when it comes to committee, that's where I would offer my amendments, similar to the amendments that I offered to Bill 47.
Okay. Councilman Ikaika Anderson, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I appreciate it. Aloha.
Ikaika Anderson is Honolulu City Council Member for District 3. Show, we took a little more, we actually more closely examined some of Hawaii's lizards and asked for the proper name of the skin flap of anole's neck on and the anole's neck. Males have excess flesh underneath their mouth that can be expanded on demand. It's primarily used as a means of attracting a mate. It's also used to display dominance among other male chameleons. These lizards will fully inflate their pink or red skin flap and bob their heads up and down frantically. It's a territorial defense that not only applies to other males, but it's also been seen in response to gardeners and dogs and anybody else passing by that they might think is encroaching on its turf. And anole erects its neck by moving the hyoid apparatus, which is a set of bones derived from the gill of support fish, with the tongue acting as the primary muscle controlling inflation. Today we asked you for the scientific name of that skin flap, and we had someone who knew that it is a dewlap.
And that someone is Max Regala, who is 6 years old, likely our youngest winner to date.
Oh, that's
congratulations,
great.
Max. You are the proud winner of an HPR T-shirt. And at 8:47, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Good morning. I'm Clark Llewellyn, Dean of School of Architecture from University of Hawaii, Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The ukulele has been much on our minds this week as hundreds of players from around the world converge on Roy Sukuma's Ukulele Festival for this Sunday. We talked with Roy yesterday about the current global reach of the humble ukulele, and this morning we're looking at it as a tool to promote peace. That's how the members of Ukuleles for Peace see it. They're from Israel, 8 of them are Muslims, 4 of them are Jews, and they've seen what music can do to break down barriers among people. Siwar Mansour, one of the group's founders, is with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
How long have you been part of this group?
Actually, from the start, 11 years. This is my 11th year.
And what was the impulse to get it all started?
Well, Paul Moore, the founder of Ukuleles for Peace, he came into my school when I was just in elementary school. Mm-hmm. And he's an ukulele player. He does that for a living. And he wanted to do something about the conflict, and he wanted to use ukulele. I mean, he's a ukulele player, so he brought the ukulele to the school, both the Jewish school in Hoda Sharon, mm-hmm. which is the schools that we collaborate with, and Tira, to my school. And he just used ukulele, as like you mentioned, as a tool to promote peace.
Is that how it worked for you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what's unique about Ukuleles for Peace is that most kids don't come from a musical background, mm-hmm. so we really start from scratch, and the learning process is together. Basically, both Jewish Israelis and Arab Israelis learn how to play the ukulele and, you know, begin their musical careers together, and that's also something that unites them.
When you do something with people, especially when you need to kind of depend on them, as musicians need to depend on one another, it does change the way you interact, because it becomes about the music rather than anything else, right?
I mean, it's both, correct. I mean, it's not, you cannot disconnect. It's not two different things. It's not the music and the people. I mean, people, it is a tool. Obviously, when we play music, we're aware that there are differences and that we come from different backgrounds and that we share different, you know, cultures. So obviously it is much about the music, because it's our way to bond, and it's our way to speak. I mean, initially when the organization just started, kids from Tira, who were about 9 or 10, and kids from Hoda Sharon did not even have a mutual language, you know, to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So music kind of was that language in the beginning. So it is a tool. It does not become entirely about the music, because also the music that we do is very much diverse. We play both in Arabic, Hebrew, and English, mm-hmm. and we all sing in those three languages.
And you don't want your background to disappear just because you're playing music. You want the music to kind of preserve it, if anything.
Yes, obviously it doesn't. I mean, even if we play only in English, it doesn't disappear, because the rehearsals actually are held both in Tira and Hoda Sharon, which are actually 15 minutes away.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is that the parents, who are very much involved in the whole process, they drive their kids into, you know, these very different cities. So it doesn't disappear because you come in into very different cities, all Arab, all Jewish. Now, actually, it's very highlighted because it's Ramadan back in Tira. So we had to actually adjust. Ramadan is the month that Muslims fast. So we had to actually adjust and, you know, change the times of the rehearsals so that the Arab Muslims would be able to attend the rehearsals. So it definitely does not disappear.
You wouldn't want it to.
Definitely not. We celebrate our differences.
Good. Let's celebrate them with some music. You guys have brought your ukuleles with you.
Yeah, Adam Sulejan is playing with me. And we'll do a medley of a Jewish song, of a Hebrew song, sorry, and an Arabic song.
Terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So you're performing tonight in town at
Temple
Emmanuel, and then you're part of the Ukulele Festival as well.
Yes, true. We have our biggest concert actually is tonight at 5:30 at the Temple Emmanuel, and obviously we're performing at the Ukulele Festival.
Have you been to that festival before?
No, this is our first time.
You will see more ukuleles than you ever knew there were in the entire world.
For sure. It's actually intimidating, you know, all these ukulele masters. I'd like to actually take the chance to thank Kathy and Roy Sukuma, who have done tremendous work to bring us here. You know, the Ukulele Festival has funded all of our expenses almost in Hawaii, and that's actually very generous.
Well, we talked to Roy Sukuma yesterday, and he was talking about how the ukulele has become worldwide.
Yes, definitely, yeah.
Did you fall in love with it right away?
Yes, I mean, it is, how can you not? It is the most, I mean, in the beginning, you know, the comments that we would get that about the ukuleles, oh, that's so cute, you know, but when we became more professional, it's actually a very, you know, interesting instrument.
It's pretty versatile, more versatile.
Yeah.
Than
yes, exactly. That's the word I was looking for.
You'll meet some of the people who have kind of expanded.
Yes, definitely.
The range of the ukulele.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much for coming, both of you.
Thank you very much.
To hear you. Siwar Mansour is a founder of the organization Ukuleles for Peace, which will perform at Temple Emmanuel in Honolulu this evening at 5:30. They'll also be part of Sunday's Ukulele Festival at Honolulu's Kapi'olani Park, and both events are free. Details are on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
We are playing ukuleles for peace. We are playing ukuleles for peace. We are playing our ukuleles for peace.
A little box with four strings, ukes are so much fun.
With our fingers drumming, we are all as one.
We are playing our ukuleles for peace.
We are playing ukuleles for peace. We are playing ukuleles for peace. We are playing our ukuleles.
You got your doll, right? You got your doll there.
Yeah.
You love your doll.
Yeah.
But what if I told you that was the only doll you were allowed to play with the rest of your life?
That's Colin Quinn as a father explaining his infidelities to his children in the film Trainwreck. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Amy Schumer, who wrote and stars in the film, and Judd Apatow, who directed it. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
Beth Ann, I can think of few better demonstrations of the power of music than what we just experienced a little bit of, yeah?
I don't know if that could be magnified 100-fold.
Well, certainly music has played an enormous part in every social movement that has ever been, and there are reasons for that. I mean, it's you know, it's obviously based on harmony. Musicians find ways to fit with one another, and it can be kind of an example for what we might want to do in life.
And the question is, can that be leveraged from this young age into ways in which people deal with each other, particularly in the Middle East?
Well, that being an area where a deep change in consciousness is really going to be the only long-term solution, and that's where those kind of changes come from, deep within.
And we'll see what happens within the lives of these two who you just spoke
yeah.
with. And certainly we'll be enjoying their music later on today and on Sunday at the Ukulele Festival.
Yeah, it's going to be a great event.
Thank you all for joining us on this Thursday morning. That's going to do it for us. It's almost 9 o'clock and we've got to say goodbye, but we'll be back tomorrow and we'll be talking with Focused ED Executive Director Scott Morishige about the meeting that's happening today with government service providers for the homeless. How far is that conversation going? We'll find out tomorrow morning.
And we'll have a choral celebration of Disney music on Kauai.
Meantime, you can be in touch with us on our talkback line. That number is 792-8217. And you can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the HPR2 archive. Links to more information about guests and topics are there, too. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkoot.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of The Conversation.